I'd like for you to imagine a little hypothetical scenario. Let's pretend that you're at home with some family. At this point, there is a knock on the door, and when you answer, you're greeted by three armed men. And they tell you that your neighborhood, town, your city is being evacuated. They tell you to leave immediately, and that you will need to travel at least 250 kilometers or 150 miles away from your home. Now, if I walk along the road to a nearby highway and stick to that for about 5 days, that will get me to a town northeast of here. It's pretty Australian sounding, Wangaratta. I've not been there before, but let's hope it's nice. Now, in this hypothetical, there are no hotels or anything like that open, because everyone is being evacuated like you are. So along the way, you'll just have to sleep more or less on the side of the road until you reach where you are going. And if you can walk something close to the average walking speed, this journey will probably take you about 5 or 6 days. As I record this, we are in the middle of summer in Australia, and actually just came off a heatwave where the temperature hit around 41 degrees. That's around 105 degrees Fahrenheit. So it's not exactly the best conditions for a 5 day walk, but those guys with guns didn't look like they were messing around. So with some of these conditions in play, I would hope you could just take what you need from your house. I guess I'd be taking as much water as I could carry, and I'd try and scrounge around in the fridge and cupboard for some food that would last the journey. All the shops are closed, so I can't just nip out to the local one and get some extra beans or anything. You can only take what you've got on hand. Does this seem like something that you could do if you had to? A 5 or 6 day walk with no time to prepare? Well, what if I made it a bit harder and said that you were going with your extended family? Let's say there are 9 of you, older members of your family, and children as well. Would that make that 5 or 6 day walk a bit more of a struggle? What if you were sick when those men came to the door? Say you've got a terrible flu or some kind of infection that's causing you a fever. What if you'd recently broken your leg or had surgery? Perhaps you were 9 months pregnant, or maybe you'd just given birth a few days before. Does this now seem like something that might be too hard? Does this seem like something that you might not even survive? Well, it might surprise you to know that this situation I'm asking you to pretend, this actually happened with stricter rules and in worse conditions. This was back in 1975 in the capital city of Cambodia, Phnom Penh. 2 million people were told to evacuate their homes that day and head into the countryside at gunpoint. Some of them would walk for weeks before they got to where they were going. And unfortunately for those that did indeed survive the journey they were forced to take, it would only be the beginning of their ordeal. What they endured in the countryside of Cambodia would turn out to be one of the darkest, most deadly periods of history in the 20th century. My name is Lachlan Peters, and I'd like to welcome you to In the Shadows of Utopia, a new podcast looking to explore and explain some of the worst periods of mass death in modern history. This being the introduction to our first series on the show, entitled The Cambodian Nightmare. What happened in Cambodia in the 1970s was, in every sense of the word, a tragedy. The story I would like to explain to you is mainly one of survival, not only of individuals in the face of terror, hardship, and murder, but the survival of an entire nation of people. While this series will cover the majority of Cambodian history in a chronological order, I'm tempted to introduce you to the subject through the events leading up to the day that the nightmare began in earnest for all of Cambodia. April 17th, 1975. But in order to do that, I'll need to set the stage about 6 years earlier, in 1969. So here is Cambodia's head of state, Prince Norodom Sihanouk, in an interview for British television.
Under the pretext that there is a war necessity, so they come into Cambodia. Already they occupy some parts of our lands, and they do not want to withdraw. Our soldiers, our army, you know, try to push them out, but we are not strong enough to, you know, push them out. But so far as the Vietnamese are concerned, you know, they have a very big population, and there is a lack in Vietnam, a lack of lands. They have not enough lands for everybody, and we have more lands than we need. So, you know, the Vietnamese, red or blues, always they have temptation, you know, to come into Cambodia and to occupy our lands. On the other hand, we cannot avoid in the future communist Vietnam from north to south. Certainly, we shall together, you know, come to that conclusion. So we have to be realistic, we, the Cambodians, because our aim is to survive.
Do you think that your people would fight for their independence?
For their independence and their way of life, their way of thinking, their own philosophy, because we do not share the philosophy of the Marxist.
Prince Sihanouk is going to play a large part in this story. Considered by many of his people to be the last in a great line of god kings, like those that built the beautiful and impressive temples of the ancient Angkorian Empire, he is an enigmatic figure. In this interview, Sihanouk is talking about the difficulties that his country is facing in 1969. He begins by talking about the North Vietnamese armed forces that are occupying parts of Cambodian land near the border with Vietnam. Cambodia's entire eastern border rests up against Vietnam, a country at the time divided between north and south. The north and south of Vietnam were engulfed in war, known in the West as the Vietnam War, which is probably the most prominent proxy war of the Cold War period. What do I mean by proxy war? Well, this means a war that is instigated by large powers, but not a direct war between these powers. So in this case, the North Vietnamese were supported by the communist powers of the Soviet Union and China, while the South Vietnamese were supported by the United States and her allies. The Vietnam War, or Second Indochinese War, or American War, if you're Vietnamese, was characterized by an attempt by the United States in particular to contain the spread of communism down from China into Southeast Asia. It was assumed that if South Vietnam fell to the communist North, then so would all the other countries in the region. Containment is a massive feature of the Cold War. It's kind of like there were two massive football teams, and they were both trying to get the best new players to join their club. Sometimes you could offer money, guns, and trade to these countries to lure them to your side. Sometimes America or the Soviet Union might bully smaller nations into joining their team. And sometimes both countries or clubs would try and sign the same player or country, which could cause problems. You could say that it would be the equivalent of a bidding war, which in reality took the form of an actual war. So, if we're using the Vietnam War as an example, both ideological sides of the war, socialist versus capitalist, East versus West, wanted Vietnam, and ideally the rest of Southeast Asia, to sign for their club. The South Vietnamese were interested in joining the US side, while the North was allied to the communist cause. Now, the war was fought mostly by Vietnamese soldiers of the North or South, and the end goal of this war was there being one Vietnam again. But both sides wanted that country to be wearing a different kit. If the North won, it would be a red jersey with maybe, I don't know, a couple of yellow stars on it. And if the South won the war, I imagine the kit would have been something like a blue top with some white stripes on the shoulder, something like that. At the time that Sihanouk gave that interview, in 1969, the Vietnam War had been going on with the support of US ground troops for about 4 years. What had started with just a handful of military advisors now totaled more than 500,000 American troops. However, despite the huge deficit between the US military and that of the North Vietnamese, the US was not winning this war. Cambodia was, officially, a neutral party in this war. They were not allied to the North Vietnamese or the South. In fact, as Sihanouk mentioned in the interview, Cambodian relations with Vietnam had always been characterized by animosity or sort of an unease that their stronger neighbors would one day take over Cambodian land. Now, in global geopolitical terms, and if we're going to follow our football analogy of sort of East versus West, Cambodia hadn't yet really picked which club they wanted to sign for. They would sometimes flirt with one side or another, though, in order to get aid or protection. In 1969, and in this interview in particular, we see this in action. Sihanouk had, until recently, been sucking up to the Chinese side to get aid, but now is looking back at the West with a kind of flirtatious gaze. Considering the volatile situation in Vietnam, this flirtation back and forth between the big two clubs, as I've been putting it, may have been a sound strategy for Sihanouk, but it would cause problems for him domestically. Okay, so part of the strategy of the North Vietnamese to win this war was using supply routes that went from North Vietnam through the border into Laos and then Cambodia, and then came back into South Vietnam through the Cambodian border. These supply routes were the main veins, if you will, that the North Vietnamese could pump resources, men, materiel into the south of Vietnam in order to keep up the fight. They were famously known as the Ho Chi Minh Trails, named after the leader of North Vietnam, and they were a fantastic logistical feat, a testament to the ingenuity of the North Vietnamese in a fight against the world's military superpower. Now, I guess you could say this strategy was kind of like committing crimes in the United States, then running into Mexico, where the American police can't get you, and then a bit later coming back to the US, do a bit more crime, and then running back into Mexico again. Now, the US can't attack the North Vietnamese in these sanctuaries, because that would mean invading or attacking a country that wasn't officially in the war, namely Cambodia. This is why Sihanouk mentions the certainty that North and South Vietnam would eventually be united under the direction of the communist North. Sihanouk could sense that the US would grow weary and eventually quit the conflict, which was a large part of the strategy of the North Vietnamese. After all, the war had been causing massive American casualties since troops were sent there in 1965. It was beginning to become a quagmire for US policymakers, and an immense anti-war movement was growing on the US home front. The US indeed was becoming weary of this fight. So Sihanouk is predicting an eventual communist victory. But he's then asking himself, what's going to happen to Cambodia when that happens? He states that Vietnam has many people, but not much land, while Cambodia has not many people and lots of land. For centuries, this had been a concern of the people of Cambodia, that they'd be one day taken over by their neighbours. It didn't matter if these neighbours were communist or not, Cambodians had seemingly always been concerned by this threat. Sihanouk says, "We have to be realistic, we the Cambodians, because our aim is to survive." This interview is an excellent example of Prince Sihanouk's political manoeuvrings. While he bemoans his country's inability to deal with the North Vietnamese forces within his country, he fails to mention that he was acquiescent in these supply routes being set up. Not only did he know about the Ho Chi Minh Trail being expanded into his nation, but the major port of Cambodia had been a dock for North Vietnamese supplies into South Vietnam for years now. This situation is indicative of Sihanouk's attempt to try and get support from both of the big clubs for his country. If he could appeal to both sides, maybe he could get aid from each, and perhaps this would be the way he could maintain his country's independence from its neighbour to the east. Like he said, it was obvious to him that Vietnam would be united under the rule of the North, so why not try and appease them before they take power? However, if he went too strong towards the North Vietnamese side, that would look to the United States like Cambodia wasn't neutral at all, and was in fact choosing the communist side. So not only did Sihanouk have to look to the outside world like he was neutral, but he also had to look like this to his own government and his own people. It was like walking a tightrope, and Sihanouk would not be the leader of his country for much longer. Less than 6 months after this interview was given, his own parliament voted unanimously to overthrow him while he was on holiday in Paris. The new government was headed by Sihanouk's former prime minister, Field Marshal Lon Nol, a military man with a penchant for utilizing mystics and astrologers. The Cambodian government had become fed up with some of Sihanouk's domestic policies, as well as his stance toward the communists. This new government would be fervently pro-US and seek as much military and financial aid from the capitalist faction as they could squeeze out. In fact, over the lifespan of this new government, they would receive just about $1 million in US financial aid each day. This new government renamed the nation from the Kingdom of Cambodia to the Khmer Republic. And one of the first goals of this government would be war against the North Vietnamese, who were using Cambodian soil as a sanctuary from US engagement. Now, this was no easy feat. The North Vietnamese stationed in Cambodia were vastly superior to the Cambodian army. This political change in Cambodia was perfect for then President of the United States, Richard Nixon. On the 30th of April 1970, just over a month after Sihanouk had been dislodged from power, Nixon announced to the US public his new plans for the Vietnam War.
North Vietnam, in the last 2 weeks, has stripped away all pretense of respecting the sovereignty or the neutrality of Cambodia. Thousands of their soldiers are invading the country from the sanctuaries. They are encircling the capital of Phnom Penh to protect our men who are in Vietnam and to guarantee the continued success of our withdrawal Vietnamization programs, I have concluded that the time has come for action. Because if this enemy effort succeeds, Cambodia would become a vast enemy staging area and a springboard for attacks on South Vietnam along 600 miles of frontier, a refuge where enemy troops could return from combat without fear of retaliation. North Vietnamese men and supplies could then be poured into that country, jeopardizing not only the lives of our own men, but the people of South Vietnam as well. If, when the chips are down, the world's most powerful nation, the United States of America, acts like a pitiful, helpless giant, the forces of totalitarianism and anarchy will threaten free nations and free institutions throughout the world. During my campaign for the presidency, I pledged to bring Americans home from Vietnam. They are coming home. I promise to end this war. We shall avoid a wider war, but we are also determined to put an end to this war.
Throughout that speech, Nixon highlights many issues that were facing the United States in 1970. First, you'll notice that he refers to Vietnamization and troop withdrawals. Now, what he's talking about here is a policy change in regards to the Vietnam War. The US public, as well as Congress, were becoming increasingly weary of the war in Indochina. So to placate these concerns, the move was made to begin withdrawing hundreds of thousands of US troops and allowing the South Vietnamese to do most of the fighting from this point going forward, thereby Vietnamizing the army that would be fighting this war. In order to provide cover for these American troops that were being withdrawn, Nixon explains that he must destroy the sanctuaries on the Cambodian border that were being used to supply the war in the south of Vietnam, these Ho Chi Minh trails as I mentioned earlier, as well as encampments of North Vietnamese troops. Nixon repeatedly states that he is not looking to expand the conflict, a fairly good indication that the United States is looking to recede from the war in Vietnam. After all, this is one of the policies that Nixon actually campaigned on to win the presidency. I'd just like to hone in on something Nixon said there. He said, if the US acts like a pitiful, helpless giant. Now, that's actually quite sort of an illuminating statement about how the US needed to avoid humiliation in Indochina. This was a big deal for policymakers, and it is one of the main reasons that Nixon was about to start an air war over Cambodia. Now, what Tricky Dick doesn't mention, however, is that he had already been hitting targets on Cambodian soil. In fact, he had ordered the carpet bombing of Cambodia, codenamed Operation Menu, well over a year before he gave this speech to the US public. Nixon had been secretly bombing a neutral country for an entire year. So the state of play in the early 1970s was like this. Cambodia was being run by a new, inexperienced, mostly inept, and pretty corrupt government. The United States wanted out of the entire region. The war in Vietnam had become a quagmire and looked to be unwinnable. Cambodia's new government wanted to fight the communists in their country, not just the North Vietnamese, but now there was a Cambodian communist faction. They were known as the Khmer Rouge. Now, these Cambodian communists had been born out of the Vietnamese Communist Party and were now becoming a fairly serious fighting force on their own, as they were supported by the North Vietnamese, as well as China. Astoundingly, the Khmer Rouge also had another significant supporter. The ousted ruler of Cambodia, Norodom Sihanouk. He had allied himself with the Khmer Rouge cause under pressure from China, and he lent a significant air of legitimacy to the communists in the countryside. However, he was not at all involved in the leadership of this movement. From 1970 onward, the fighting in both Cambodia and South Vietnam continued. The US was steadily withdrawing ground troops. Nixon was more than happy to provide death from above, however, and the bombing campaign in Cambodia would result in more than 500,000 tons of ordnance being dropped on the countryside. Now, I understand that numbers and tons of bombs can be a little hard to imagine, but this is a staggering amount of bombs. All right, comparatively, the US dropped 160,000 tons of ordnance on Japan during the entirety of World War II. So let that sink in for a second. More than twice as many bombs were dropped on Cambodia, still officially a neutral country in this conflict, than was dropped on Japan in all of World War II. Many of these thousands of bombing raids over Cambodia were indiscriminate and inaccurate, causing thousands of civilian casualties. Estimates range from between 10,000 to 150,000 innocent people lost their lives. The effects of this carpet bombing will be explored later in the series, but for now, all you need to know is that this did not stop the communists from taking over more and more parts of Cambodia, and perhaps played a role in boosting support for the Khmer Rouge in civilians that were adversely affected. So let's move forward in time a bit. By 1973, continuing down the path that Nixon had laid out, all of the US combat troops had been withdrawn from South Vietnam. By this time in Cambodia, it had become apparent that all the financial and material aid the US was supplying to the Khmer Republic could not stem the tide of the Khmer Rouge. The communists were a hardened force by this time, utilizing the experience of the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong troops. The Khmer Republic troops were poorly organized, inexperienced, and corrupt. For example, officers would often lie about the numbers of troops in their battalion in order to get more wages and supplies. And they would even often sell these to the communists, pocketing the extra cash. The Khmer Republic army was plagued by things like this. And by early 1975, the result of the war was becoming more and more apparent. The Khmer Rouge controlled most of Cambodia, except for some major towns and cities, Phnom Penh, the capital, being the most important stronghold for the fledgling Khmer Republic, who could barely even count on the US bombing anymore. The anti-war movement in the US had won, both in the public and in Congress. At Kent State University, four student protesters had been shot dead by the National Guard. Nixon had been impeached in the Watergate scandal, and President Ford had inherited the mess that the previous three presidents had set up for him. It was time for the United States to get out of Indochina. They had not been able to get these players to sign for their team, and they had wasted a lot of money, done a lot of damage, and killed a lot of people in trying to do so.
Word that the U.S. was pulling out of Cambodia came early Saturday morning. Journalists and foreign residents were told to assemble at the U.S. Embassy before 9. The decision was to close down the entire U.S. Embassy in Phnom Penh. Ambassador John Gunther Dean would evacuate with the rest. The military situation around Phnom Penh at the last report was stable. However, President Ford's speech yesterday, in which he asked for no more military aid for Cambodia, apparently has had an effect, prompting the embassy to pull out. American Marines were flown in from the USS aircraft carriers Okinawa and Hancock to carry out the helicopter lift. A school several blocks from the embassy served as the makeshift landing zone.
That report came out on April 12, 1975, just 5 days before the eventual fall of Phnom Penh and total Khmer Rouge victory. For months, the Khmer Rouge had been tightening their noose around Phnom Penh. In January, they'd mined the rivers leading into the besieged city in order to halt supplies of both munitions and food. The capital had become swollen with refugees. Perhaps 1 million people had fled the fighting in the countryside, as well as the US bombs. In March, Prime Minister Lon Nol decided he would not stick around to see how the fighting would end. He fled the nation by plane, taking with him over $1 million in what he deemed as some kind of retirement fund, and he went to Hawaii. So, by mid-April, Cambodia and its people had been left to fend for themselves, by the United States and by their own government. The war was undoubtedly going to be won by the communists. The only question remaining for the Cambodian people and the people in Phnom Penh was when, and what would this victory look like? The answers to both of those questions became apparent on the 17th. Now, reading and listening to numerous accounts of the events of that day has always fascinated me. Listening to what went on that day, but knowing what would come after, I just find it engrossing. Now, Pin Yathai's account gives a great sense of some of the thoughts and feelings of the people living in Phnom Penh at this time. He was an engineer, he was highly educated, and fairly well off. He was wealthy enough to not feel the more arduous effects of the nation's 5-year civil war. He had at first quite high hopes for the Lon Nol government, but had realized its ineffectiveness early on. He presumed, like many others, that the Khmer Rouge were not as much communist as they were nationalists. Some even saw them as patriots. They were, however, a mysterious army, No one even knew the identity of their leaders. He thought, like many others, that some of the more extreme stories that they'd heard about the Khmer Rouge, about their ideology or their conduct, was just propaganda spread by the Khmer Republic government. He had joined in the opposition to the Lon Nol government, and he looked forward to the civil war's end so that national reconciliation could occur. Assuming that some kind of coalition government would be formed, he, as an engineer, saw no need to flee the country and assumed that he would be needed in rebuilding his country once the war was over. By the morning of the 17th of April, it had become clear that the fighting was in the capital itself. You could hear shelling and sporadic machine gun fire in the distance as Khmer Republic forces retreated to the point of surrender. People tried to find areas within the city that seemed safe from fighting, and they awaited news of what would happen next. In Pinyathai's account, he remembers congregating with his extended family in the inner city around a radio. At around 10 a.m., a voice familiar to them, Hut Tat, the country's most senior Buddhist monk, came on the radio, and he said, "Don't be alarmed. Stop fighting. Peace is coming now. Our country has passed through a difficult time. Now we must rebuild." Following this, a second voice came on the air, that of General Mei Sichuan, the chief of staff of the Republican Armed Forces, and he said, "All soldiers should put down their arms to avoid a bloodbath while the negotiations are continuing with our brothers." Now, obviously, Pinyathai and his family were relieved. They all smiled at each other and sighed with relief. It seemed that finally the war was over. However, a second later, the general's voice was swamped by, as Pin puts it, a confused babble. Then another, unfamiliar voice broke through onto the radio, and forcefully, as if someone had seized the microphone. This voice exclaimed, "The war is won by weapons and not by negotiations. The government forces have surrendered. The underground forces have triumphed. Now the war is over." Then, no more talking. No music or anything like that. Just gentle static. An hour passed, and the family discussed what they would do next. Then, in the distance, they heard cheers coming from a nearby boulevard. Phnom Penh has these fantastic wide streets in the heart of the city. It's a very open city. It's spacious, plenty of trees, gardens, and French colonial-style villas. They approached the sound of the cheering to see what was going on when someone shouted, "It's the Khmer Rouge!" As they ran over to the street where the large crowd was gathering, they could see that all up and down the street, the houses and windows were dotted with white. People had hung out anything white they could find. Sheets, shirts, towels. It was like a parade. And just like a parade, people had lined the streets. They were cheering as the victorious army began marching down the streets of Phnom Penh. That is when Pinyathai, and basically all the residents of Phnom Penh, would first lay eyes on the Khmer Rouge. I'll quote the passage from his truly amazing and heartbreaking book, Stay Alive, My Son. The roadway was clear, with the crowds pressed back along the sidewalks. Down the middle of the road, in single file, divided into squads of about 50, walked a line of soldiers such as I had never seen before. They were all in black, in simple pajama-like uniforms, without decoration, but neatly buttoned. They wore black Chinese caps and Ho Chi Minh sandals. Sections of car tire kept on with strips of inner tube. Some carried AK-47s, others had rocket launchers. All of them had checkered cramars, headscarves that they wore around their necks or over their caps. They were not walking in step, but there was nothing sloppy about them. They just stared straight ahead, unsmiling. Not one of them appeared to be over the age of 18. There was something disturbing about those stony-faced teenagers. All the more so when I saw the welcome that they were receiving. City people followed the columns, clapping and cheering in an outpouring of relief, all fear gone. but the crowd's enthusiasm made no impression on the grim youngsters. They just stared straight ahead, blank, impassive as automatons. End quote. A few hours later, the crowd's enthusiasm and relief that the war was over would be cut short. The stony-faced expressions of the teenagers in black would be replaced with far more animated ones. By the afternoon of the 17th of April, a secret order had been issued to the Khmer Rouge captains in the city. The reclusive leaders of the party had begun to implement their plan for Phnom Penh and all other major towns and cities in Cambodia. The nation's capital, with all 2 million of its inhabitants, would be emptied immediately. Some Khmer Rouge exclaimed over loudspeakers that the Americans were coming to bomb the city and that everyone must leave for 3 days until it was safe to return. Give you some kind of reference to this. If you've ever been to some large-scale public event, you know, with thousands and thousands of people, like a music festival or something like that, you might have experienced moments of anguish as you move through crowds of people slowly, or perhaps you've lost your friends or family in this sea of people. Well, this was a mass movement of people that rivals any in history. This was 2 million confused people being marched out of a city at gunpoint. There were no exceptions from the evacuation. Even hospitals were emptied of their patients, sometimes wheeled along in their beds by nurses, or hobbling along on crutches with recently amputated limbs. Those that could not move were shot. Those that questioned the evacuation too much were shot. Parents could lose their children in the chaos. Families would sometimes become separated and not find each other again. Huge columns of people filled the wide boulevards of Phnom Penh and slowly moved out in all directions to the countryside. They would not be returning in 3 days' time. This time there would be no American bombs coming. In fact, there was no one coming. Cambodia was about to become democratic Kampuchea. A new kind of country where no one could leave and no one could come in. In the words of the party, the most pure revolution in history had just begun. January 7th, 1979, exactly 3 years, 8 months, and 21 days after the events of April 17th, 1975. It's a breezy, bright day in the middle of Cambodia's cool season. on one of the highways leading into the nation's capital, one of the same highways which had seen hundreds of thousands, millions of people trudge away from their homes in Phnom Penh, was now carrying a large force of people back in. It was not the Cambodians returning to their abandoned homes, though. It was a large battalion of the Vietnamese army. Note that I said the Vietnamese army then, not the North or South Vietnamese army. Vietnam, the entire country, had been ruled by a single government for just under 4 years. In fact, Saigon, the capital of South Vietnam, had fallen to the North only a couple of weeks after Phnom Penh had fallen to the Khmer Rouge. The group of trucks, tanks, artillery, and combat troops heading toward Phnom Penh were part of a larger force which had invaded Democratic Kampuchea just weeks earlier. It had taken the Vietnamese army almost no time to penetrate their neighbour to the west. They encountered little resistance. Phnom Penh was about to fall for the second time in less than 5 years, and once again to a communist army. The Third Indo-Chinese War was almost over. Yeah, the third one. That's counting the first, which is fought against the French, the second against the Americans, and now the third between states inside of Indochina. Phnom Penh sat undefended. The Vietnamese simply drove into the city. The capital of Cambodia, once called the Pearl of Southeast Asia, a bustling, cosmopolitan beauty, was now a dead city. I mean that almost literally. In the same way that a garden will wilt away and decay if uncared for, leaving, you know, nothing but hollow, dry stems and sticks. This is what had happened to Phnom Penh. It was the shell of a city. A husk. There were no people, no animals, no sounds. In contrast to my analogy of a dead garden, the city was actually being reclaimed by grass and weeds. As a few of the Vietnamese trucks and personnel drove down the wide, empty boulevards toward the central market, they noticed that there was money blowing about in the wind, sitting in the gutters. The economy of pre-revolutionary Cambodia had been rendered obsolete since the Khmer Rouge took power. That money was worthless. The central market, a huge building consisting of a large central dome, with four arms of large hallways branching out from its sides, was surrounded by barbed wire and debris. This market had been known in the past as one of the largest in Asia. It had teemed with noise and life. The bright yellow paint which covered its exterior was now dulled and covered in grey grit and mould. This market, the heart of Phnom Penh, had stopped beating. The armed convoy moved south, down Norodom Boulevard. The four lanes of the spacious road were empty, and many of the streets which intersected with this major boulevard were closed off with barbed wire, the street signs painted over in black. Piles of rusted cars, abandoned in 1975, adorned some intersections, while groups of mopeds just sat in the middle of others. Artifacts of the evacuation. Phnom Penh had been completely emptied for the last 4 years, with little more than a skeleton crew of top Khmer Rouge officials and workers having lived in the city. They had done nothing to maintain it. About halfway down Norodom Boulevard, the convoy drove past the Prea Sisawath High School. The school was one of the few that had been opened in Cambodia by the French back in 1873. Some of the alumni of this high school included many prominent Cambodians, such as Yang Seri, Kiu Ponari, Yang Tirith, Kiu Sampan, and Saloth Sar. That last one, Saloth Sar, was known more by his revolutionary name, Pol Pot. These men and women who had graduated from this prestigious high school more than 30 years ago were leaders of the Communist Party which took over Cambodia. They had fled Phnom Penh before the Vietnamese invaded, and Saloth Sar, Pol Pot, was their leader. Brother number one. And Sar, as a teenager, He'd used to play football in the oval of the high school, which was now being passed by the invading Vietnamese army. As the invading convoy kept driving south on Norodom Boulevard, they stopped at the large stone tower in the middle of a roundabout. It's fashioned in the style of a lotus flower, and it served as a monument to the independence of Cambodia from the French in 1953. There, they convened with another armed battalion, which had scouted the city's southwestern sector. And by the afternoon, Phnom Penh had been completely secured by this Vietnamese force. And in a sense, Cambodia had been liberated from the leadership of the Khmer Rouge and Pol Pot. The next day, in the southern sector of the city, not far from the Independence Monument, Vietnamese photojournalist Ho Van Thay had been given permission to explore the city. He had accompanied the army into Cambodia to document the Vietnamese invasion and was keen to capture some footage of the city which had been liberated by his government. As he began walking down the streets off of Monivong Boulevard, astounded by the post-apocalyptic scene he was strolling through, Tay was drawn southeast by a dreadful odour. Passing by rows and rows of abandoned houses, he came down a tight little street, at the end of which stood a sort of compound. The silent, malodorous sight was behind a large tin fence, which was topped with coils and coils of barbed wire. He walked toward his right, along the street until he found a large iron gate, again topped with rows of barbed wire. Above the gate there was a red placard, and written in yellow paint on this was a slogan, which said, "Fortify the spirit of the revolution. Be on the guard against the strategy and tactics of the enemy, so as to defend the country, the people, and the party." The place carried no other signs of identification. The photojournalist stepped toward the gate, peered inside. He saw no movement and heard no people, but the smell was aggressive. He pushed the gate wide enough to squeeze through and entered the mysterious compound. In front of him was a small, one-story, white building. To the left of that, around 200 meters away, and connected to this first small building by a large grassy area, was a much larger three-story building. It was about 100 meters long and had balconies running along each floor. To his right was a mirrored version of the grass and building to his left, and he could see that behind the building in front of him were two three-story buildings, the same as the others, partitioned down the middle. The corridors of one of these buildings' balconies was covered in barbed wire. The whole compound looked dilapidated, but Ho Van Thay realized that he was standing on the grounds of a high school, or what had been a high school. It had been transformed into something else. It was unclear what this compound was, but as Tay walked cautiously into the first building that was in front of him, he realized that this one must have been some kind of administrative office. It was littered with papers and office equipment, and it looked as though it had been hastily and recently abandoned. He left the first building and walked toward the southern side of the compound, to his left. Across the grassy space before him was one of the large three-story buildings. It was painted white, but it was suffering from the same greyish grime and mold affliction that most of the buildings in this dead city now seem to have. He approached the large building, following his nose towards the foul stench. The building's three balcony corridors cast shade against the greyish-blue paint of the shutters, which enclosed the windows to the rooms, which Tay figured had been classrooms not that long ago. The breeze gently blew against the leaves of a palm tree that stood in front of the what now seemed quite imposing white building. Tay approached the classrooms on the bottom floor, slowly opening the door to what would have been the second classroom along from the left. It had a grey door, whose paint looked stressed. Tay stood in the doorway, looking up from the mustard yellow and white square tiles. The room is painted a dark yellow, which stops at a roof which is painted white. It's a small classroom, maybe 5 meters across and 10 meters long. There is a window at the far end, letting in a large amount of sunlight. And next to a chair, tucked into a single small table, is an iron bed frame, just the frame. Shackled to the end of this bed frame is a man, laying with his face up. His throat has been cut very deeply. The pool of blood beneath him still looks wet, and the flies are incessant. Tay had discovered one of the sources of the stench that had led him to this place. There were several men found like this within this building and the others. Altogether 14 were found, all seemingly murdered only a couple of days beforehand. The Vietnamese photojournalist had stumbled across a vicious and important Khmer Rouge facility, the apex of the security apparatus utilized by Pol Pot's Democratic Kampuchea. The compound was known during the Democratic Kampuchea era by its codename, S-21. More than 14,000 people were sent to the former high school. The prison was used to interrogate perceived counter-revolutionaries and enemies of the party. It would become an infamous and grim example of the brutality and callousness of Pol Pot's dark reign in Cambodia. No one was safe from a sentence to S-21. Regular people, as well as top Khmer Rouge officials, were sent through its gates. It was a death sentence. But only after long and crude torture, enforced confessions of guilt, as well as shockingly poor conditions of imprisonment, had been endured. Whole families were devoured by this institution. As one Khmer Rouge slogan explained, enemies must be pulled out by the roots. About 20 minutes drive south from Phnom Penh, trucks of people would be knelt by mass graves, blindfolded and struck in the skull, usually with some kind of agricultural tool, like a hoe or the axle from a cart. The sounds of revolutionary songs blaring from a stereo hanging from a tree would drown out their screams. Children, infants, were murdered here too, sometimes swung by their legs against a tree in front of their mothers. The death and suffering which occurred in these two places, the prison and this execution site, represent only a fraction of the misery which took place over the 3 years, 8 months, and 21 days following the fall of Phnom Penh on April 17th, 1975. What had happened to Cambodia in that time? To all the people that had been evacuated from the cities? Why had a high school been turned into a torture facility? How could this regime have produced people loyal enough to murder a child for being a political enemy? Why did Vietnam invade Democratic Kampuchea? Why did all of this happen? This series will be my attempt to explain to you the answer to that question. An answer which will hopefully tell you the story of how more than 2 million people died at the hands of their own government. How a utopian vision for a country would produce one of the most violent and oppressive regimes the world has ever seen. How the interplay of global and local forces somehow produced one of the great tragedies of the 20th century, and how the rest of the world would somehow fail to alleviate this suffering. This is a long story, one that will require some telling. I think what happened in Cambodia has to be explained from the start, and that means the ancient past of this country, the heights of Khmer history, the glories of the Angkorian Empire, more than 1,000 years before the nightmare of democratic Kampuchea. And that will be the subject of the next episode. Once again, I'm Lachlan Peters, and I'd like to thank you for listening to the first episode of In the Shadows of Utopia. The music you've heard throughout was produced by Ryan Willis, and I'm very thankful to him for that. If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you might like to subscribe to it. And if you would like more information, please visit www.shadowsofutopia.com.